Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Homage to the Buddha, the blessed, noble, and fully self-enlightened.
Do you want to put down?
If you're all right.
Yeah. Is it going now?
Yeah.
For posterity. It's just an opportunity I take just to, as a reminder to some, but also as an introduction to a few of you, just about the principles of meditation and the difficulties we come across and why we do what we do, basically. When the Buddha talks about right awareness, when the Buddha talks about awareness, he talks about a certain type of awareness, about right awareness. It's not as though awareness ever leaves us, in a sense, because even in sleep there's a residual awareness. I mean, something must hear the alarm clock. It would be dead. So it's this particular type of awareness that the Buddha's talking about, and the point of the awareness is to take us out of what he called dukkha. So this word dukkha is very central to his teachings, and it translates as a hard place. And we normally see it translated as unsatisfactoriness, or at worst, unhappiness. Just a feeling of life not delivering what we hope it would. That's at its most subtle, meaninglessness, all that sort of stuff, you know, existential angst, that sort of stuff. But also just the ordinary pains and horrors of daily life. All that comes under this wonderful word dukkha. And he said that his teaching was basically about dukkha, about this situation we're in, and the end of it. So a bit of hope there, you see. And this right awareness was something that he himself discovered. We say that the Buddha was self-enlightened, not because he didn't have teachers. He actually went to two of them we know of, and practiced what we now call the absorptions under them, these very beautiful mental states that we can get through our meditation. And he also practiced some heavy mortifications, which we think was through the influence anyway of the Jain leader, who was his elder contemporary, the Nigantha. Although these gave him techniques, they didn't actually help him to really answer the question that was sort of eating away at him as to whether there was an end to suffering. And in his day, that would have meant, as it does to people who believe this, that just constant rebirth, just repetitious rebirth. We experience it every day. You wake up and off you go, you know, wash, breakfast, work, back, eat, bed, up, breakfast, but back. So it's just it's like a machine. We do it every, you know, then weekend, Monday off we go. Monday's what? Is that what you do? You get up, you eat, you go go back to bed. So is that when you take that on a more cosmic level of like every lifetime, then it's really boring, you see. So he, this idea of rebirth was pretty horrific in his time, and it's and for those of us who understand that, it's pretty horrific to think about it too. So that was his the core of his unsatisfactoriness, really. So remember, he'd left his home life, which had delivered all the pleasures that in those days you could achieve. He was fairly well-to-do family, a governing family, the ruling class, and left that. And then he did all this other stuff with beautiful mental states, but they disappeared, and he just ended up being same old depressed Gautama. and then he tried this self-mortification, which he said was just painful and ignoble. So you got nothing unprofitable, painful and ignoble, so you can't get worse than that. So you can see he comes to a point where, you know, he's pretty despairing, and I imagine him, you know, really at the end of his tether, And as the story goes, somebody's passing by, a woman's passing by, a bit of rice pudding, and offers him, and it sort of revivifies him. And we all know the salvific effect of rice pudding. So something happens at that point. It says that he remembers something in childhood, and I think this is really kernel, that he, of how he was watching his father doing the ploughing ceremony. He's a child watching his father, and there was something about that watching which was different. He was in an absorption, he was absorbed, but there was something different about it from all the absorptions he previously experienced. And that difference was this inquiry, that difference was this sense of what is happening, this what is it, or the question in the mind, just that wonderful childlike curiosity. And it was that made him think, well, maybe this is it, maybe I've got to investigate, I've not got to try and achieve happiness, I've got to investigate the way things are, and then with the insight there comes the liberation. And that's exactly what happened. So once he was liberated, he began to teach, and again the core word is this sati, samasati, right awareness. And when he talks about right awareness, he's talking about a way of looking at something, a way of investigating something. And those were the three characteristics that we did during the sitting meditation. It's seeing the impermanence, radical impermanence. It's seeing how we create suffering for ourselves, and it's seeing that whatever we experience does not constitute me. It's not a me. It's only because it arises and passes away. So the idea is that when we sit, we first of all have to draw the attention into a direct experience of what we're actually experiencing, which means that we have to come off thought. So remember, thought is a big barrier, because words, concepts, they hold our history, and what it does is it makes us look at things from this prejudicial point of view of past experience. It stops us experiencing things as they are in this present moment. Even at a very simple level, and I'll be reminding you this when you go and eat, just eating a fruit, an apple or something, as soon as we see an apple, as soon as we taste it, we put it into a category. We measure it against all other apples that we've had. We compare it, and it's either a great apple or a useless apple or a tasteless apple, but we never actually taste this apple, as itself. It's always in comparison with. And to do that, you've got to really let go of the mind. You've got to really go, and you do that by putting your attention directly upon your taste. You see, because the taste doesn't lie. What I mean by that is that whatever your taste buds are giving you, that's what they're giving you. You don't have to layer it on top with some sort of comparison about past apples. It's not going to help this present, the tasting of this present apple. People who are wine tasters do that sort of in a natural way, because they've really got to taste it, and after they've tasted it they can compare, but not while they're tasting it. It would destroy the actual direct experience of the taste of wine. Not that I do it these days. It's only an example. So when we understand that, there's this real effort in the meditation to draw the attention, to draw this intelligence that we have out of its confusion with the intellect. Most of us would, before we come to meditation, would think of ourselves as being the intellect. I think, therefore I am, that sort of thing. But actually, what the meditation primarily has to do is to bring us out of it. And it does that by centering upon the body. And the body, as it were, is giving you sensations and feelings, and they don't lie. They're not comparing themselves to anything. They're direct experience of sensations and feelings coming into that intelligence. See? And what we have to do is put this question mark in the mind. And this question mark, this curiosity, is not coming from this place of, oh, I know, yeah, everything's impermanent, I know that. So I'll see if I can see. Of course I can see it. The breath rises and falls away. It's the problem, But the thing is that to do that is, again, coming from this perceptual level, from this conceptual level of transiency. It's not actually drawing us into the fact that this me is also arising and passing away. The mind is capable of joining all these things together to give us this sense of continuity. We have that example in a film. I mean, we know, well, in the old films, we're on the DVD, but in the old films, when you had those little frames and they all shot off at a different speed, we know that they're all separate frames, but we don't see that. You don't see it. What you see is continuous action and continuous sound. That's the magic of the mind. But unfortunately, it confuses us at this very deep level of thinking that I'm always existing. So I know my body's changed. I have pictures of me a little baby. So I know it's changed, but I haven't changed. Huh? And my emotions are not the same as they were with three, but I haven't changed. My thoughts are not the same as they were even a few years ago, but I haven't changed. See, there's always something in me that says, well, I haven't changed. You know, so where's that coming from? Where's this sense of I coming from? This idea that, well, in the midst of all this change, it's quite obvious to me, I'm not changing. I'm there all the time. Where is it? Where are you going to find this I? So by investigating, by really looking into what we're actually experiencing, we're also undermining the way that we create out of these experiences this continuous sense of I. See? So that radical sense of impermanence is achieved through, you know, very closely observing everything which arises and recognizing that in fact even the process of cognition, the process of moment-to-moment consciousness, only arises with an object. You can't be conscious of a non-object. So if there's non-object, where's consciousness gone? Now, that's one thing that we very much associate with, is our act of cognition, our act of consciousness. So that's one way of achieving it. The other way, of course, where we see transience in, it really hits deep within us, is when somebody dies. Especially when somebody close to us dies, you know. And it really, really hits us hard. The Buddha says people don't really wake up until it hits you hard. See, until the doctor says you've only got 6 weeks to go. And then you hit this business of, well, who am I? See? So this who am I is a very deep question, which is actually one of the core questions of Korean Zen Buddhism. That's the koan. For those of you who know the koan system of asking a question, that's their question. They don't do all that funny stuff about, you know, what's the sound of one hand clapping. They're just happy with saying, who am I? If the mind answers, you know it's deluded. That's the point. So as soon as the mind tells you who you are, you know that's it, can't be that. But you're really stuck. So this sense of the actual grasp of impermanence is one way of breaking through the delusion of the world we create as something constant, something continuous, something substantial. And it is said that even that would take us to the end. Even just constantly being aware of impermanence would actually bring us to the end of our suffering and unsatisfactoriness. In fact, there's a nice little tale, which I'm sure some of you know, about a monk who was so dull-minded that he said that when he, in those days, remember, they had to learn the teachings. There was nothing written. It's very hard to understand, but the Buddha was illiterate. And he said that whenever he learnt a phrase of the Buddha's teaching, it would knock the one he'd just learnt out of his mind. So his brother said to him, look, you know, you're just not going to get anywhere. You better go back and dig the fields. And when the Buddha heard this, he went to see him, and he said to him, look, he said, don't worry about that, you stay a monk. And he said, just take a piece of cloth, and a clean cloth, and just keep wiping the sweat off your face and rubbing it, and as you do that, just keep looking at the cloth and saying, anicca, impermanence, impermanence. Well, he was fully liberated, just by doing that. Now, it didn't work for me. Maybe I didn't try long enough. But that's a little story that tells us that actually just to see one of these characteristics and take it to its real depth, you'll come across the others. By seeing anicca, by seeing impermanence, you see it's ridiculous to hold on to anything. And the Buddha says that's one of his greatest gifts. When we see anicca, when we see impermanence in its real deepest sense, there is nothing, absolutely nothing in the world worth holding on to. That's the Buddha's words. See, that's the liberation that comes in seeing anicca. And by not holding on to something, you release yourself from a lot of suffering. But also by seeing anicca, by seeing this impermanence, we also grasp that it can't be substantial. If it can't be substantial, then it can't be me, it can't be mine, etc. So anicca, impermanence, is a gateway into the other two characteristics of existence. The second one is concerned with the second noble truth. So the first noble truth is a very simple, straightforward, bold statement. There is dukkha, there is suffering, that's it, isn't it? And the second one is that the cause of it is desire. The psychological level is desire. Now this is not all desire. I have to be careful here. The desire to meditate, the desire to be liberated, is not an unwholesome desire. But the desire, which is an expression of our deep delusion, is something that we have to recognize. And that deep delusion is that we're seeking happiness in the sensual world. Right? We think this world will deliver, so long as I've got, you know, the right partner, right job, right car, and so on, see? And once you've got it all set up, you think, well, that's it, I'm going to be happy forever, you know? And then it all corrupts you, you know? So, it's a case of recognizing that whenever we're seeking happiness in the sensual world, it's going to cause us problems. And that's really the what we were doing in the meditation when I asked you to observe your resistance to what you don't want. So that's a desire, that's the negative desire, not wanting, and your desire to hold on to and to develop what was pleasant. So you're watching that process of wrong desire. And even that, if you see that to its very end, you see, you catch this grasping nature, you grasp what it is that's actually grasping, and what we're actually seeing is this relationship we have with the world. Now, this relationship we call the self. See, this is the problem with concepts. They coagulate something into an object which seems to be impervious, it seems to be impermanent. Even with like little things like, you know, you say, well, this is a dog, and you have a picture of a dog, and it has a sort of stillness about it, a substantiality about it, but we know that the dog is in a process of change. We know that something which is very long lasting is also in a process of change. We know that these mountains that we see are actually moving, you know, I mean, I've tried to see that, but it's very difficult. But they say they're actually moving, and it's sort of grasping that makes us realize this sense of every time we conceptualize the self, actually what we're doing is we are conceptualizing or substantiating, making into something real, which is actually a fluid relationship. If you take, for instance, marriage, you see, you say marriage, see, that points to a type of relationship as though it was something static, a marriage. But you know, it has all sorts of, you know, it's a moving animal. It moves and it's constantly this relationship. What the word marriage is describing is a relationship that is in a continual state of change between two people. Right? It describes a certain type of relationship. This self is the relationship that the knowing has with the world it finds itself in. It thinks this is it. And as we meditate, what we're doing is we're relocating out of the body. So the body, a body self, which perhaps we experience most as little children, is something that we find very difficult. Something really big has to happen to get us back into a body self. Like, you know, if you catch your finger in the door, see, for that one ecstatic moment, there is only the body. You know what I mean? Now that's the, and that, then you shoot out of it and my finger's hurting. You've lost that identity with the body. So there is a body self. The one that we find easy to lose ourselves into is, of course, the emotional self. Very quickly, I am angry, I am depressed, I am happy. See, we're quite happy sort of disappearing into an emotion, becoming an emotion. In a meditation, we're pulling ourselves out. Instead of saying, I am depressed, we're saying, there is depression. There's some separation, there's some dislocation from it. And that dislocation means that we must be relocating. So we must be finding another place within us to observe an emotion. So in the same way, with thoughts and images, normally speaking, we're lost completely in those. I mean, just consider, from the moment you wake up to the moment you fall asleep, does the mind ever stop? You know? After all years of my meditation. So the mind is in a constant state of offering us thoughts, offering us images, etc., etc. And when we are in this meditation and we see an image, see, so we're saying, you know, we can see imaging, or we can, you have to have good concentration with it. Sometimes you can see a thought actually come, it's like a neon light just passing through your head. And even when we do that, you see, somehow we've relocated out of the thinking process. See? So we've relocated three times, which we can do by an act of will. This is within the power of the self, the so-called self. We've come out of the body, we've come out of emotions, we've come out of thoughts and images, and we've made them objects to observe within us. And we've discovered this very peaceful place. See, when you're in that place, really ask yourself, what does it feel like up here? Yeah? We're in the position of the observer, the objective feeler, the one who knows, the one who experiences. But there still is the sense of self. You're still aware of yourself being the observer, so you can't be that either, can you? There's another object, you see. So so there is yet one more relocation to go, see. But that becomes completely out of our power, because as soon as you try and get rid of a self, there has to be another self trying to get rid of it. See, so you're into a double bind. You can't go any further. So we get out of that double bind by attending entirely to what's happening, and the sense of self-awareness disappears. Now, we do that quite naturally when we're very interested in something. It's very easy to lose your sense of self in a film, DVD, and you wake up afterwards and you know that you weren't aware of yourself, what you were just watching the DVD. So why is it that after all these DVDs that I've listened to, I'm not enlightened? Because I keep losing myself, see? And I lose a sense of time. That's another thing about self. As soon as you lose your sense of self, you lose a sense of time. And it's because we enter into those situations with the wrong intention. So we enter into a DVD saying to ourselves, I'm going to enjoy this, you see? So I'm seeking happiness in a DVD. See, I'm seeking happiness ice cream, see? So I can lose myself in all these wonderful things, but it's actually reinforcing a sense of self. I'm saying now, I am happy when I watch a DVD. I'm happy when I have Costa coffee. See? And we're constantly reinforcing a sense of self around an experience. Now, what we're doing through meditation is letting go of all that as a place to find happiness. Right? As a place where we can really seek peace, etc., etc. And so now, from this position of the observer, from this position of the feeler, the experiencer, we have a very different attitude. Our attitude is to really begin to see that everything that I'm experiencing, which is the world, the Buddha is quite clear about that. He says, this world that I'm experiencing is completely made up by me. You have to consider that. You know, what comes into my eyes, what I see is only what I see, it's not what you see. We can agree on certain things, but basically I experience the world different from you, and this is my world, and I'm creating it. And when I separate out of that world that I'm creating and it becomes an object of my knowing, see, then by putting my attention entirely on that and to see it very clearly as being something which is ephemeral, which has no substance, which is just being created all the time by my mind, I'm beginning to that investigation, that curiosity draws me into a concentration whereby I become absorbed in the process of investigation. That's a very different experience, you see, because that's liberating. And in that absorption into the process, I lose that sense of self, lose a sense of time. And when I come out of it, if it's been a proper absorption, there's always a reflection. You'll always find a reflection coming on, because, and this is where sort of one of the mysteries, this knowing, this intelligence we have, this Buddha nature within us, doesn't know what it knows until it tells itself. And that's the purpose of the intellect. So when the Buddha had this amazing experience under that tree, he then spent 3 nights thinking about it. 3 nights. He went through the dependent origination one way. Those of you who know dependent origination, it's the psychology of the Buddha. He went through it the other way, and then the next night he did it up and down to make sure that he got it right. And then he went out and began to teach. So there's always this reflection about what it is you've actually seen. And these moments of absorption are not, you know, they don't have to be, you know, days long or something. They can be just snippets. They can be just little moments. Sometimes, especially in the beginning of our meditations, we're not even aware we've done it. Is that? But these are little turnings in consciousness. These are little turnings which eventually begin to accumulate into something that begins to penetrate deeper into our psyche by way of an attitude. And it's these little seeings that make us begin to question our attitudes, change our attitudes, and these attitudes then manifest in the way we speak, the way we act, and what we do with our lives. And there's your Eightfold Path. It manifests naturally as the insights come to us through the meditation. So that's what we're trying to do. See? Now, in the attempt to do this, we have Mara. Mara is the evil one. Yeah? Mara is all the hindrances that arise, that drag us away from our meditation. And you can generally split it into two types. There are those which make us very excited, and there are those which send us into a black hole. Now, the ones that make us very excited are things like planning my holiday, lovely desires, sex, drugs, rock and roll, great stuff. And then there's all the aversion stuff, the hatred, the irritations, want to wring their necks, all that sort of stuff. Depressions and anxiety, can't do this, can't do that. Self-doubt. Self-doubts you have to be very careful of, because remember that doubt, skeptical doubt, is very undermining. What skeptical doubt does is it stops you from action. It arises from a lack of confidence, a lack of self-esteem. And if you think about that in your daily life, it can really be quite paralyzing. You know, if you have a relationship, you know, is this the right person, wrong person, right where the other person goes? You've missed it. This is the right job, right? The job goes, somebody else gets it. So this skeptical doubt is rooted in fear, it's rooted in aversion, self-aversion. And when you have that sort of doubt, make sure that you let go of all the fabrications of the mind, all the thinking, and just go into the feel of it. Go into the feel of it. Real doubt, well, I'll show you real doubt, or proper doubt, wonder, is of course the emotion of the philosopher. It's the philosopher within us that wants to know. And that wonder manifests as statements such as, well, I know the Buddha was enlightened, but really, I don't know, you know. And maybe, well, we know it's not a cock and bull story. You just want to make a new religion and be famous. Who knows what he was doing? So it's a case of a wonder. The Buddha wants us to investigate what he says, because all he's offering us is a hypothesis. Right? He's not saying that he can liberate us. He's saying, well, this is what I did, and if you want to try it, this is the way to do it. So these hindrances which draw the mind away, the real thing that we have to grasp is that every time the mind manufactures a dream based on an emotional state, it is developing itself, whether you intended it to or not. Right? Because as soon as the emotion arises, whether it's some craving, some irritation, some depression, whatever it is, as it comes out of the heart and touches the mind, it wants to express itself. And there's a moment there when we are unaware, and that's why it happens so quickly, when the old habit jumps in and you have a conditioned response, and before you know it, you're off into a dream world. And in that dream world, this emotion is developing itself. That's why the mind is so pernicious. The more you think about how depressing the world is, the more depressed you become. It's very simple, isn't it? The more angry you get about how the world is and all this business of climate change and all that, the more angry you become. See? The more you allow the mind to run away on its thoughts, the more it's developing the emotional state, which is the attitude that you're developing. So, in our meditation, as soon as you wake up from a thought sequence, a dream sequence, it's telling you what is in the heart. Is it anger? Is it fear? Is it frustration? Whatever it is it boredom? See? As soon as you know that, you come into the body and you contact directly the feeling of your emotion. You bury yourself in it. You feel it. I often come across people who've done lots of meditation who seem to have been instructed to see impermanence and to see the not self, and somehow the teaching around dukkha has been missing. I've had enough sort of responses from people to begin to perceive that somewhere along the line, in the teaching of Vipassana, people are not being taught to actually feel their emotions and experience them. Because I get reports that suddenly something's come up, like grief or depression or something, and the person didn't know what to do with it, you know, and then they go to therapy, which is fine. I mean, therapy is very helpful, but this is much cheaper. And all you got to do all you got to do is just sit with the stuff, right? That doesn't mean to say that if something comes up very violent, very, you know, where it's actually making you afraid, that you shouldn't seek help. Of course you should. But the healing, the psychological healing, the therapy of Vipassana is in the bearing with, is in the sufferance, the open-hearted sufferance of the emotional state that's arising. And it may be that as you turn inward and you feel your depression and you feel your fear, it becomes much greater. And that's because you're allowing it to manifest. Now, you're in control of the process. All you have to do is stop meditating and have a cup of tea. Yeah, which is the great panacea, as you know. So it's a case of really, really grasping that. You see, every time, and this is not just in meditation, this is in your daily life. This is while you're having a cup of tea, while you watch, you know, while you talk. Every time the mind wanders, it's developing a particular attitude. See? And when you know that, when you really grasp what you're doing, then, you know, you get more and more, you know, quick about bringing your mind back into the present moment. And remember, everything you attend to is an act of intention. You know, these billboards on the street, why do they still have them? You know, I mean, we've got all sorts of ways of advertising. Why do they still have these silly billboards all over the street while you're watching on the bus? Years ago, there was a doubt as to whether they had any effect whatsoever. So I don't know, some of you might remember, it was way back in the 80s actually, if I remember rightly, early 80s, to prove, the people who owned these billboards, to prove they worked, they introduced this perfume. And it was from Australia, and it had, you know, the Australian hat with the corks all around it on the top. Does anybody remember that? And it had a special name, and everybody thought, that's fantastic, and everybody wanted to know where it came from. And it didn't exist. What it proved is that every time you look at a billboard, it goes in. An act of attention is an act of intention. It has an effect. That's why you don't think so much about what you're going to buy when you walk into the shop. You already know. The billboards have told you. The adverts have told you. So, keeping that very clearly in mind, that whatever goes into the mind is conditioning it. And every time the mind goes off on its little dreams, it's reinforcing that conditioning. So there is this instruction from the Buddha to be very careful about what we put into the mind and to practice the virtue of restraint, you see, of not feeding that desire, not feeding into it. So that, in a, you know, just as a general instruction about what you do when the mind wanders, you just come off it. You acknowledge exactly what the mind is doing, not in terms of its subject. You're not worried about what it's actually doing. You're worried about the attitudinal force behind it. Is it anger? Is it depression? Whatever it is, and you come back into the body, right? And you feel it in the body and stay with it as best you can. And recognize that turbulence in the body is actually blowing itself out. See, that's the point, it's blowing itself out. There's a lot of it. And the other side of the equation is this business of the black hole, you see, the pit. So the dullness and lethargy, see. So, again, that's a mental state. We don't tend to think of it like that. It's a mental state. And it's been developed in two ways. First of all, we like sleeping. Huh? Especially that one on a Sunday morning where you sort of wake up and you're on that sort of little level. Yeah, and you sort of just about wake up to get a cup of tea. And then you come back down and you lie out. And then you look at the newspapers and you... Huh? You know that one? So that's this lovely subliminal state of sleep, which is very pleasant. So once you've got, then you come and sit here, you see, and you're very still. Well, what does the mind want to do? It wants to get into this lovely subliminal state, and just off it goes. So you have to resist that. You have to keep waking up. That's why I say these three basic things about lifting the spine, open the eyes a bit, let the light in, stand up. You refuse, you see, just refuse to be annihilated. That's the basic, that's the commandment. And the other side of it is that we've used sleep to escape things. You know, so when you feel a bit fed up, feel a bit depressed, well, you lay out on the couch, you know. If it gets too bad, this neon light comes up, doesn't it? Head for the bed. And you just, that's it. Lay out for a few hours, you know. And you wake up and it's all been nicely suppressed, you see. Sometimes it doesn't happen like that. You feel even worse. But for the most part, for the most part, we use sleep to suppress, see. Remember, all suppression is aversion or fear. Aversion or fear. So that's why in daily life, if you have something come up and you know it's the wrong time to deal with it, you know, you don't want to be in work telling anybody how depressed you are. So you can put it to the side, you see. Your attitude is, I'll just put that to the side and deal with it later. That's not the same as suppression. Suppression has to be something negative. And that force is actually adding more turbulence to the system. Whereas just to say, I can't handle it at the moment, and just to leave it to the side, is no danger. As long as you give it time later on in the day to actually contact it. So that's the other side of the hindrances. Or those, well, there's only two actually, dullness and lethargy, which draw us into this black hole, right? So just all we have to do is just keep making the effort to wake up. And if you can, to make those feelings the object that you're investigating, right? And one way is to just keep the attention moving up and down the body and just try to find out where you feel the heaviness in the head. If it's this dullness, you just wander about, you see, and the more you keep the attention moving, the more it stays awake. And you may surprise yourself to find that you can be as awake in the most dull states as you would be in one of the brightest of states, because you're drawing your energy back into the process of observing. And the motivating force of that is this interest, is this wanting to know. Okay. So just to sort of bring it all together, we have to get ourselves into a position in the meditation where we can observe. So we use the breath to establish that sense of the observer, the feeler, the knower. And once you're there, you bring in that quality. I forgot to say that. To make the breath somewhere where you want to go, begin to experience it as something pleasant. You know, it's actually relaxing. And when we experience it as something pleasant, not as something that we have to do, then you see you want to go there. You want to actually still yourself on the breath more. It becomes a pleasant place to be. Then you raise this curiosity, you see, and find this observation post. That's still, I think, it was reviewed actually in what's that newspaper from America? The Inquiring Mind. Do you know it?
Yes.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah, there's a review there by Joseph Goldstein of The Heart of Buddhist Meditation by Nyanaponika, and it still is the classic book on meditation. If you want one, you know, easily readable. And you you find yourself in this position of observer, and if you want, you can consciously raise the intention to observe impermanence, or to be more aware of the process of wanting and not wanting, or to investigate this sense of not me, not mine. You see. And the noting is very good at that, because as soon as you note something, it's got to be an object, see, there. And within that process, we get dragged away. So we have to be very clear that every time we're dragged away on something, we know what to do. And we re-establish the process by going back to the breath, and that's it. And remember that if the whole of your, you know, regular 2-hour morning meditation is what? is this continuously coming back into the present, coming back, that's the practice. That's not bad meditation, right? If you say to yourself in the meditation, if you sit there and say to yourself, I'm a little bit fed up with this. I think I'll just relax. That's bad. You ought to feel really guilty, right? And if you sit there and say, I'm going to do a Vipassana meditation, you think, what am I going to do this evening? Yeah, no, I'll think about this. That's really bad. I really feel deeply guilty. But if the whole of the meditation is wandering, thinking, planning, coming back gently, coming back, make a resolution, stay here, coming back, that's it, that's the practice. Yeah? If you congratulate yourself after a practice like that. And if you sat there all day long, well, waking up, you've done this before, I'm sure, for hours and hours, that's good practice. That's good practice. That's what it's about. It's about waking up, you see. But if you're down there and you think, well, I'll give you... then you should really, really feel very bad about it. You've got a confession. So if you want to... So that's it in a sort of nutshell. So what we could do now is some walking meditation, and with those people who are helping out, would they like to go over and help? And then we'll come and do a sit at 1 o'clock. I've left it a bit late now. Is that all right? Is that all right, Paul? 1 o'clock, and we'll do a short sit before we take our meal at 1:30. And then we come back about, what would it be? 2? 1:30. 1:30. 1:30. Is it? You need a bit more than an hour, do you? Mm-hmm. About 3:15. I prefer to work in the morning because, you know, after lunch, like, it's good enough for doing loving kindness, just about. So yes, please, we'd like to do some walking meditation, and if there's any questions about the practice, just stay behind and ask me them.
Well, it's similar. It's always unique.
Yeah, there's always something. Yes, because I find I learn as I go along a little bit.
Mm. And the jokes are wonderful. Don't forget the jokes. Thank you so much.